Well, get ready for this trip tonight. 3 hours with investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. This is a very powerful and detailed interview concerning an entire story about a United States Air Force flight surgeon who was in the surgery room during one of the autopsies on an extraterrestrial biological entity in the late 1940s. Linda's done a lot of work about this story. She will share it with us all next on Coast to Coast AM. Linda Moulton Howe is an Emmy Award-winning television producer, investigative reporter, author. She goes directly to the men and women at the forefront of science and environmental challenges, at firsthand eyewitnesses of high strangeness. Her website is earthfiles.com. She's a graduate of Stanford University, master's degree in communications, and she has devoted her documentary, film, television, radio career to productions concerning science, medicine, and the environment. And she has been working on just an incredible story. Hi, Linda. Welcome back. How are you?
Hi, George.
Good to hear from you. You've been traveling lately?
Well, yes, I have. And this story comes out of my appeals on Coast and Earth Files and Dreamland going all the way back to December, January, February. Remember when I began saying on the air that if there were people in military and intelligence or new people who had firsthand experience concerning the extraterrestrial biological entity story, to get in touch with me, because it's very clear that this administration not only has a policy of denial, but wants to erase all information that there is. I was back at the National Archives in January doing research with some colleagues, and almost all the files that I had gone back to search and that had been released during the Clinton administration had all been reclassified. And so we are in a very difficult time in trying to get facts and truth. And it was after those appeals on the air and at Earth Files that on April 24th, I received an email from a central Ohio businessman named Ronald Sequoy.
Okay.
He is 59 years old, and he got a bachelor's degree in clinical psychology from Ohio University, but he's worked in a variety of businesses ranging from restaurants to retail since he graduated. He is a family man with three children, and he considers himself a devout Christian. He has asked that his home city and company's name be withheld for protection, as well as the name of the flight surgeon that he is going to discuss in this 3 hours or 2 hours that we're going to unfold this story tonight to protect that man's family.
All right.
Now, his first email stated, quote, "I used to work for a man in Dayton, Ohio, retired U.S. Air Force flight surgeon, who in a moment of great stress and emotional breakdown told me he was one of five military doctors called in to look at two alien bodies at Wright-Patterson Base," unquote.
Wow.
Now, last month in June, I emailed Mr. Sequoy and asked for more information, and he wrote back, quote, "He," meaning the flight surgeon, mm-hmm. "lived in Dayton always. He was the flight surgeon for an entire SAC wing. He did not tell me precisely when this occurred, just that it happened in the late 1940s, near the time of Roswell. He said how he got phoned while sleeping, had to rush out to the base. The three generals were there, three. What he had to sign, threats made. The five doctors were involved. Only two doctors actually touched the body. The one alien was dead but showed no injuries. One was burned and had a horrible hole in one leg, with an anguished look locked upon its face in death. He was a devout Catholic, and this had destroyed his belief system. He was furious at the government for involving him and for ruining his life and threatening him. He was terrified of the government, and he made me swear never to tell anyone. So for years, I never really did tell people the story. But to the best of my knowledge, he's gone. And I think the public deserves to know," unquote. Now, on June 27th, with his permission, Ronald Sequoy and I talked by phone in a two-hour recorded interview. And tonight on Coast, I would like to share segments of that interview, over the next 2 hours and then take phone calls in the third hour. And I hope that there might be listeners who have their own firsthand Wright-Patterson Air Force Base or other military base experiences which you can or will share with me on or off the record. My email address is earthfiles@earthfiles.com. My news website, which contains a large Real X-Files section and this report tonight in its entirety, is at www.earthfiles.com. Now, the date that the flight surgeon talked to Ronald Sequoy began in Christmas time of 1975 and continued through five in-depth conversations over the next several weeks. The older retired Air Force colonel and flight surgeon had formed a father and son relationship with Ronnie Sequoy, who was working as a manager in the older man's company. The extraterrestrial autopsy described was in the late 1940s at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio. Here now is Ronald Sequoy with the story.
Listen closely.
One day I probed him on that subject about what were the things in the military that had caused so much stress for you, and to my utter surprise, he broke down and started crying. And I thought, my goodness, this man must have really been through some military campaigns that had really affected him. And he told me, I can't tell you. You wouldn't understand. And one day he called me on the phone and said, I'd like to spend some more time with you, but instead of just an hour or so, on your day off, could you have lunch with me? And I said, sure. And he goes, and I'll pay you for it. And I said, well, you don't have to do that. And he said, that's all right. I'll give you a half-day pay. Well, I realized why when we got together for this luncheon. It didn't last an hour or so. We were together 2 or 3 hours. And one of the things he entered into was religious belief. And if I believed in God, and I said, very much so. He was out of a Catholic background, he said, and I was out of a Methodist background. And he really was probing why I believed in God. And I asked him, well, do you believe in God? And this look came over his face that haunted me because I really liked this man, and the subject seemed to shatter him talking about it. And that's all we talked about was God, and do you believe in the Bible, and that sort of thing. And I thought, gee, this is such an odd series of conversations to be having with him. I wonder what's causing this.
But what was the look that came over his face when you asked him if he believed in God?
His whole countenance changed. This very handsome, together, very formal, aristocratic man, everything melted in his face as if he was terrified. And his hands would shake. Hmm. And I'm going, what experience caused this that he would shake? And the whole concept of talking about a God, and if God was real, why was he doing this with me? It almost frightened me because, you know, it's my boss I'm talking with, and you know you're always warned don't get too personal with the person you're employed with or that can end up to haunt you and you lose your job. And I like my job. So I said, did something happen in the military to break your religious beliefs or your belief in God? And he broke down. He began to cry in this public restaurant over in a corner, the worst cry I'd ever seen in my life. I decided right then and there that my faith that I had, whether it cost me my job or not, I had to figure out what was doing this to this man, why he was so broken down about this subject, what did he experience in the military. And again, I'm assuming it was the death of people, that it was warfare, that maybe people that he saw die. So I started probing him on that subject, and he turned and looked at me, and he said, I cannot tell you. I have restrictions. It's something I absolutely can't talk about. It has to do with national security. And that caught me by surprise. I said, you mean like secrets or something? And he said, absolutely like secrets. Things that I'm sworn under oath I can't ever divulge. And the meeting broke up on that note when we started talking about that subject and that he was under oath. He couldn't ever talk about what was disturbing him. It wasn't like he was out of the military a year or two. He had been out of the military many years. And what could it be from his past that was such a big top secret deal that he couldn't talk about it now? I didn't understand that, particularly for someone that was not like a command officer or something. He was a flight surgeon. What would a doctor in the military have that was so secretive that he couldn't talk about it years later? And this next time we got together, when he drove up to where I was and walked in, I saw a total, complete countenance change on him. When he came in, I saw the colonel. He came walking in like a military man. And when he sat down, he said, "We need to talk." I said, "Yes, sir." It went through my head. He's back in the military. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's going to relate this subject to me that happened to him. The next few minutes, he talked about top secret type things, that when you give an oath in the military, you can't divulge things. And I said, "These many years later, were these combat things?" And he said, "No, sir. I told you before, it wasn't combat." But this kind of gut-wrenching problem that affects someone sure looks like death to me. And this look came over his face, and he said, "Yeah, it had to do with death." Death of men under your command? No, but death. What could it be? And then he broke down. He said, "If I told you something, would you absolutely give me your word that you would never tell a living soul on earth?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he goes, "You couldn't tell your wife." "Okay, I won't tell my wife. You'll have to absolutely swear to me. I mean, you're a religious man. Will you swear on God's name?" I said, "I can't do that because it's against my religious beliefs." And then this look came over and he said, "I understand that." When I was in the military, he said, I was a doctor. I was in charge of a wing in SAC. All the military records and making sure the pilots were tested out about fatigue and all their problems about medical conditions. And I said, "Then you say you're a flight surgeon. Were you a surgeon?" He said, no, I'm a doctor, but I was more an administrative officer of doctors under me and all the records and everything." And I said, "Does this thing have to do with your job as a flight surgeon?" And he said, "Very much so." He said one night he got a call from the base at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and he was told he had to get to the base real soon. And he told the person on the phone that he would be there in about 2 hours. And a general came on the line, and a general he didn't know who it was. And he was given a direct order to be at the base in 45 minutes. And so he had to scramble, and he realized he couldn't go casual, and he put on his uniform and jumped in his car. And then when he got there, another anomalous thing happened. Normally he would just go through and just drive onto the base through the checkpoint. He had a sticker on his car, and of course the people at the guard post would know who he was. And there was a vehicle waiting for him. And he was told to follow it, and he was escorted onto the base. He wondered, are we in an alert, or has there been a plane crash, or what's going on? Because this had never happened to him before, he said.
And what year do you think this was?
Later, that very subject came up. He did not say the exact year, but he said in the very late 1940s. And I realized that one of the things he was doing here was trying to figure out how to regain his faith. That he admired the fact that I was a grown man, and that I had religious beliefs, and it showed. So anyway, instead of going to the big administrative end of the base, which was the only place he ever worked, they went clear across the base to another area, to a series of buildings that he had never even been in. He was ushered inside by military police with an escort, and he went, "What is this?" And he began to have fear, because that was back in the era of the Cold War, that perhaps something wrong had happened in the world, and perhaps we were in some kind of alert. And when he went inside, he was met by a general that he had never met before. He didn't give me any names. He was taken into a side room, and when he went in the room, the general closed the door and said, "Sit down." He sat down at a table. The general sat down across from him, and he was expecting an explanation of what this was all about. And instead of an explanation, the general slid a piece of paper across the table at him and said, "Read that." And he looked at it, and it was a kind of form he had never seen before. And it had to do with security, and it was about a level of security clearance he had never heard of before. And he turned it over, and he said, "What do you want me to do with this?" And he said, "I want you to sign it." And he signed the thing. He said, "Why did I have to sign this?" And he said, "Because you're just about to enter into another level of military experience that you're not familiar with, and a certain level of keeping secrets that requires this level, and I have to warn you about something." What followed was threats. All his time in the military, he had always been treated with the most respect, and the fact that he was a colonel, he was really put off his psychology, that suddenly here's a colonel having him sign a special high-level top-secret form, and then he's being told that what you see here, what you hear here, you can't ever take off this base. And you can't ever talk about it to anybody unless you're addressed by your superiors. and that what you're about to go through, you have to only talk about with your superiors and with no other members of the military, nobody below you, nobody in the medical end of all the people that he dealt with on a daily basis. He couldn't discuss it with them. He could only discuss it when it was brought up by his superiors, and he could never take it off base. He couldn't talk to his priest. He couldn't talk to his wife. He couldn't talk to anybody about it. And that if he ever was found out that he discussed what was about to happen with anybody, it could end up destroying his military career and could even end up in court-martial. And before he could say anything or ask any questions, he said they immediately were walking up a hall. And his head was swimming by all this. What can this possibly be that I'm having to enter into a whole new world here of relationship with the military? And before he could get an answer, somebody walked up to him, handed him a clipboard, and on it was a notepad, and they handed him a mask. And he said, what's this for? And he said, just put it on. And when he walked around the corner, there were two more generals, one that he knew from the base and another general he did not know. And now he was really terrified because he's in the presence of three command structure generals. It never happened in his life that he was in that kind of position. And before he could ask any questions, he was walking up a hall towards a door, and there was a window in the wall that you could look into the next room. And inside, there was like lights set up, and he saw a photographer. Again, he thought through his mind, a crash, because they were taking pictures inside, and it just went through his mind, they've got bodies here. And the door opened, and he was told to walk in. And when he got inside, he just froze. And he said his whole world turned upside down by what he saw when he went through the door.
And in this next half hour, George, we will hear in great detail, it's the first time I have felt like perhaps through this flight surgeon and Ronnie Sikoy that I am seeing what actually happened in at least one of the autopsies of an extraterrestrial biological entity creature at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in sometime from 1947 onward. And there will be much to talk about as we keep evolving this story through the next 2 to 3 hours. And as we come to the end of each audio, George, we can have some information
sure.
update, and you can ask questions. But in this next segment, this is where this flight surgeon is ordered by these three generals to observe the autopsy of something that there's no words, no explanation. Imagine this, being yanked out of bed, a colonel at Wright-Patterson, three generals tell you, take a notebook, take a pad, write down what you see. And that is what happened to this man.
Linda, this has got to be one of the most riveting stories I have ever heard.
Oh, I thought so, too. And wait till you hear how it continues to unfold.
And you picked this up during one of your appearances on Coast to Coast. Somebody called here?
Well, it's hard to know whether it's Earth Files, Coast, Dreamland, because I started in December and January putting out that appeal on Coast and at Earth Files and at Dreamland, asking if people had firsthand experiences. And I have now over 200 really substantive emails. The problem is the vast majority say, I cannot. I will not go on the record, but I want you to have this information.
Yeah, they're still scared. All right, stay with us, Linda. I'm looking forward to the next segment. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment, like Linda said, 2 hours of this, and then the last hour we're opening up the phone lines, you and Linda Moulton Howe. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Linda Moulton Howe with now part two of four parts on this very remarkable story. And I got to tell you again, Linda, even the guys in the studio just were glued to the speakers during that last interview segment.
Right, and that's how I felt on the telephone. And right now, where we left off is that he has these three generals. They are taking him down a hallway. He has no preparation. He has no idea where he's headed. Think about this. He has no idea where he's headed. And now, let's move on with the story.
He wasn't given any preparation for it. No one said anything to him. Nobody warned him about what he was about to see. He was just told, go in and stay along the wall, that there were other doctors in the room, and from your scientific expertise, being a medical doctor, observe, and anything that comes to your mind, take notes. When he asked, what do you mean by that? This one general told him, it'll be self-explanatory. And when he walked in, he saw that there was an autopsy going on, that there were two medical doctors dressed up in garb, they had a body on a table, and that there was lights on this, and that there was camera equipment, both motion picture and a man taking still photography, and that there were two other men along the wall that he later found out all five of them were doctors, and that one room they were all military doctors. There were two tables side by side, and on the two tables were two dead alien beings. He said that his whole world shattered that day, and he began to cry as he related the rest of the story. And his hands were shaking, and every once in a while, he would stop and tell him the story and revert back to, I don't know why this happened to me. He said that one of these alien beings looked perfectly normal, that you didn't see anything wrong with it, but it was obviously dead. But the alien being on the table next to it was just the opposite. It was horribly burned, had a horrific wound in one of its legs, but the look on its face, he couldn't forget it, was the look of anguished horror at the moment of its death. And it was frozen on this being's face. The autopsy was already going on. He couldn't say anything to anybody. He was just frozen in silence. He said the stench was unbelievable and that he was overcome by the situation and wanted to vomit, but he knew he couldn't. He wanted to run out of the room, but he knew he couldn't. And that for the first several minutes that he was in the room, that he just was transfixed, staring at what was going on and wasn't writing anything. And then he remembered the directive he was given, write. Anything that comes to your head, write it down. So he said, with almost not looking at the paper, just staring at what was going on, anything that came to his head, he wrote it down on the paper. He said that these were obviously living creatures, but unlike any kind of living creature that he'd ever seen before, he said it was like they weren't real, like they were dolls or something. And I said, I don't understand what that means. And he said, they just didn't have the appearance of being weathered. And I said, I don't understand what you mean. He said, well, look at your skin. Think about living creatures. They're not pristine. They don't look like a doll sitting on a shelf. These creatures didn't have any signs of age. I said, you talking wrinkles? He said, exactly. They didn't look like they were wrinkled. They looked like big, huge, four-foot dolls. They were not powerful beings. I said, what do you mean by that? He said, strong. They didn't have big shoulders. They had real slender arms. They were not powerful at all. Slim fingers and just small frame. They were not big. These were just little creatures. And the first thing about them that he noticed right away was when they were looking at one of the eyes. He said that this eye that they were examining, it wasn't anything like a human eye, and it didn't even look like some kind of living creature's eye. He said it was more like an optical instrument. He said it had layers, and it looked like some kind of optical device more than it did a real eye. It wasn't like it was living tissue like you would see in a human eye or any organism. He said it was more like an optical device from a camera or something like that. It didn't look living. It looked mechanical. And he said the second thing that he noticed and wrote down, these creatures didn't have sex organs. And that led to him medically beginning to think, there's no way for them to relieve themselves. There are no exterior orifices. If these things are living creatures, all living creatures eat, and all living creatures expel waste. I don't see how they do that, he said. And the next thing, he started looking at the mouth and went, the mouth doesn't look like it's a carnivore, like it would eat like an ape, or was kind of like hominid, but it was nothing like a human being. It looked more like, kind of almost like an insect, he said, in the shape of its head. And that the insect part of it, maybe that's why its eye was so funny, that it was totally different than a human eye. It didn't look like it ate, like it was solid food, or that it might live on fluids or something. But then knowing how a human being expels liquid from its body, how did this creature do that? And he couldn't see any signs of that. And then he said they opened up the thoracic section of the body, and that it had organs and internal components, but nothing like a human being, and not nearly as complex. And that really got his attention right away. You open up a human being, it's just packed with all sorts of things, including the GI tract and the lungs and all that. And there were living things inside, but not what he would have thought of. These creatures weren't as complex as we were. There was just things missing inside of them. It baffled him they're obviously a living organism, but how does this living organism function? And the next thing he noticed, he said, was its hands. Their hands were, for the size of the body, larger, but very delicate with long fingers, and there was something odd about them. There was like pads on their fingertips. And I said, do you think these things were intelligent? He looked at me kind of stunned, and I said, well, how could they not be? This isn't their world, and they're here. And I hadn't thought about that. I was just overwhelmed by the story. These are extraterrestrials. These are people from another world. And now I'm starting to get overwhelmed by the whole thing. And this was what was disturbing him so bad, this event that happened to him in his past. He said that the next thing he noticed about them was that he didn't see anything else in the room but them. And I asked him, what do you mean by that? And he said, clothing. They were naked, dead bodies, and you didn't see anything that might belong to them in the room. And he said, exactly. There was nothing in the room. And there was this horrible stench, unlike any smell he'd ever smelled before. And that when he started watching their bodies and just looking at them from head to toe, he said they had a very pale complexion, but what was their body, the skin, their covering, it almost had a fabric-like look to it. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, I mean just that. It was obviously their flesh, their body, but it sure didn't look like soft human tissue that is on a human body. This was nothing like anything he'd seen before. It was just like it was fabric. It was almost as if it had a suit on, but that the suit was its flesh at the same time. And he said it also dawned to him when he was sitting there, they got the wrong people here. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, since these things aren't really human and just sort of kind of look like humans, why don't we have zoologists here or anthropologists here or people that understand more life forms than just human beings?
And, George, remember recently I had on Coast the Navy Chief Yeoman Thomas Coleman Shepherd?
Yes.
And he was in Okinawa at the White Beach Naval Base on Thanksgiving night of 1976. That would be 1 year after this conversation between Ronnie Sequoy and the Colonel Flight Surgeon from Ohio. And Thomas Coleman Shepherd described the black and white photographs that he and two other colleagues saw in a classified vault, and the photographs were in files that were stamped MAJIC, which is the classification stamp for Majestic 12 in all the leaked documents that I, Bob, and Ryan Wood and others have seen. Well, in those drawings, he drew for me what he remembered of the photograph, and one of the details were long, thin fingers that had pads on the end. Now, that is a correlation with this autopsy description. Thomas Coleman Shepherd also said that it was odd that it looked like skin, but the skin, he even used the term, the skin was wrinkled, like you would think of cloth being wrinkled, but he thought they were nude. This idea that we are dealing with entities that were retrieved in the late 1940s from vehicles, aerial vehicles that were described by our own government in a variety of documents as interplanetary, celestial, and finally, enemy weapons system, as they were later on described. And when you realize that you have a body that this flight surgeon, as he's describing to Ronald Sequoy, is seeing skin, quote, that is not organic, and he's seeing eyes that are not organic. They are described as optical instruments, and today we have a word for this. It is called androids.
Yes.
With robotic parts. And I want to reinforce another paragraph from what I still think is one of the most important books ever contributed from firsthand military intelligence knowledge, and that is The Day After Roswell, that was first released in 1997 and was authored by U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso.
That's right.
On pages 45 to 46 is this paragraph, quote, this is Colonel Corso talking about his handling and seeing this material. This is not second, third hand removed. This is Corso describing his own experience. Quote, I was most interested in the file descriptions accompanying a two-piece set of dark elliptical eyepieces as thin as skin. The Walter Reed pathologist said they adhered to the lenses of the extraterrestrial creature's eyes and seemed to reflect existing light even in what looked like complete darkness, so as to illuminate and intensify images in the darkness to allow their wearer to pick out shapes. The reports had said that the pathologist at Walter Reed Hospital, who autopsied one of these creatures, tried to peer through them in the darkness, actually picking it up and looking through it, to watch the one or two army sentries and medical orderlies walking down a corridor adjacent to the pathology lab. These figures were illuminated in a greenish-orange, depending upon how they moved, but the pathologist could see only their outer shape. And when they got close to each other, their shapes blended into a single form, but they could also see the outlines of furniture and the wall and objects on desktop, unquote. George, this is a description of lenses that were looking at the world in infrared.
That's right.
Okay, so what I'm beginning as an investigative reporter to see more clearly, it seems like every day, the more pieces that we have had leaked, or in this case, Colonel Corso wrote this book before he died the next year, piece after piece, it is coming together like a big puzzle, and we are beginning to realize that another reason why the Truman administration, and I know that the cover-up goes back to the Roosevelt administration, and we've talked about that on Coast before, but the Truman administration had a policy in which they wanted to shoot out of the sky this, what they called disc technology, and that their own military began calling enemy weapon systems because down at White Sands, proving ground at the time, now today White Sands Missile Range.
Missile Range, yeah.
We had the German scientists in Project Paperclip who were bringing German rocket missile research here, and we were launching them only to find that round objects that were captured on film would appear instantaneously. They didn't see them coming from any place. They would appear instantaneously next to the V-2 rocket launches, and as soon as they appeared with it, what they called the disc technology or peculiar phenomenon, the V-2 rocket would veer off course, and there would be crashes that would, of course, be explained by our government as gyroscopic failures to the local media. Now, when you look back then, and the Truman administration was trying to shoot these down, there is evidence coming from people like Andrew Kistner, who was a state representative in New Mexico, who tried so hard to get to the bottom of what really happened at Roswell, and said that there was retaliation. We were not dealing with an intelligence that was passive and just monitoring. There was retaliation in taking down our electromagnetic grids of power, interrupting a whole variety of things, and there is testimony in the Majestic 12 documents and the Interplanetary Phenomena Unit document that we lost planes, literally planes and pilots disappeared out of the sky when these craft were around. It wasn't just something of melt and fire. They just literally disappeared. And these statements are written in the first, what's called the first annual report by Majestic 12 in what we think was 1952. There's an earlier report by the Interplanetary Phenomena Unit in 1947 when FDR was president. His Army Chief of Staff was George Marshall, and who was head of the Interplanetary Phenomena Unit and wrote memos to FDR on IPU stationery or memos, was George Marshall discussing the interaction with craft And when we fired artillery in 1942, February, in Los Angeles, in the so-called Battle of Los Angeles, now we have leaked documents that say our government took down or retrieved, whether we shot them or something, we retrieved two craft. Well, all of this then leads to the question, how many bodies and craft did we have before 1947? And was this a shock to this colonel flight surgeon? He had no concept at the time of an android with robotic parts, but the Truman administration might already have known that some or all of the entities that they had gotten in crashes were not technically fully biological. And George, looking back into the 1940s, that fact alone must have been astonishing to the president, to the military people, to the scientists. And one of the most interesting, and when we come back in the second segment and we hear that next audio, I'm going to quote from some of the leaked documents about who the surgeon might have been in that autopsy room, what our own government's documents, more than one, have said in detailed description. And what interests me is there seems to be so many more than one that what was on the table in front of this flight surgeon that sounds so much like the photographs of Thomas Coleman Shepard is different from our government's own descriptions in a training manual that was written by Majestic 12 for very special units to go out and retrieve. The title says, Extraterrestrial Biological Entity Retrievals and Recovery. And when we go into this next segment and we hear more about this flight surgeon and we come back out of it, I'll share some more information from these leaked documents that show that our government has had a great deal of knowledge for more than half a century.
Okay, Lyndon, we also come back. I want to get your gut instinct into Ronald Zacoy and get your views on him, especially after you spent so much time talking to him. Richard C. Hoagland, by the way, just sent me a message, and he had a friend who was an engineer at White Sands and went on to become a leading science fiction writer, G. Harry Stein, and he claims that many of the things you just talked about and attested to at White Sands indeed happened. So there's some more corroboration from just another outside source. Stick with us. Another hour to go of Linda Moulton Howe's special report, and then in the final hour we'll open up the phone lines. In addition to questions, she's asking if any of you have any first-hand or second-hand knowledge. You might want to share it with us, or at least get the information to Linda somehow. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, let's review a little bit before we go into the next audio segment, if you would, and then I want to just get your thoughts on Ronald Zacoy.
Well, Ronald Zacoy is fundamentally, in all communication with me, has been straightforward, has provided all information that I have asked for. And like so many other people, he has to worry about his life, his business, being jeopardized.
Sure.
But he really feels strongly, like Thomas Coleman Shepard and a few others, that this is way past time for the facts and the truth to come out. If our government has a policy of denial, at least people who have some firsthand knowledge, if they will just step up to the plate and talk, and you will hear in the, as we unfold in this hour, his own thoughts about why he contacted me.
Okay, give us a little review and then go right into your next segment, Linda.
And where we have been, this is a discussion between a colonel flight surgeon and his employee, who was a manager of the retired flight surgeon's company in Dayton, Ohio, and the time frame where this series of deep conversations took place over a period of weeks was from Christmas time, 1975, on for about a month. And Ronnie Zacoy was managing a company that this retired flight surgeon was operating in Dayton, Ohio, which is not far from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where this flight surgeon had lived his life, worked, and retired. And we have been hearing how he was jerked out of bed around 2 o'clock in the morning by a phone call from the base, told by a general who came on the phone to get there in 45 minutes. He knew something serious, couldn't believe it when he got there, and there were three generals, and they, without any orientation and no explanation, handed him a clipboard, gave him a pen, and told him to enter a room and to make any notes as a flight surgeon of anything that came to his mind. And that, as he said, was when he walked through a door and his world turned upside down, because what was on the table were two extraterrestrial biological entities that were clearly not human, and he even compared them to being doll-like. And what we are now going to go into is something that may actually have been described, George, in a July 22nd, 1947 Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit summary. This was leaked to Bob and Ryan Wood, who produced the excellent MajesticDocuments.com website.
Right.
You can see this entire Interplanetary Phenomena Unit July 22nd, 1947 summary at www.MajesticDocuments.com. But before we go into this next audio excerpt from Ronald Sukoy, I want to share a paragraph that describes an autopsy that might be the two surgeons at Wright-Patterson that the colonel flight surgeon was observing. And here we go. It says, this is about bodies that were recovered from White Sands at the Trinity site. Dr. Detlef Bronk has been asked to assist in the autopsy of one well-preserved cadaver to be done by Major Charles Ray, REA. From what descriptions the team was able to learn and from photographs taken by intelligence photographers, the occupants appear in most respects human, with some anatomical differences in the head, eyes, hands, and feet. They have a slight build, about 5 feet tall, with grayish-pink skin color. They have no hair on their bodies and are clothed in a tight-fitting flight suit that appears to be fireproof. Some of the bodies looked as if they had been burned on the head and the hands. Their overall stature reminds one of young children. It is believed there were male and female genders present, but that was hard to distinguish. Okay, now we know that the flight surgeon said he could see no sexual organs.
Right.
Or orifices, and he estimated that they were 4 feet tall, and he compared them to dolls because they were so perfect looking. And here we have this issue of this tight-fitting flight suit. Well, that may be the way the Interplanetary Phenomena Unit report described what the flight surgeon said was inorganic skin, a fabric instead of skin, along with those optical eye devices. And in this report, the idea of the android was in detail, but this may be the same autopsy, and that the two doctors doing the work that is being observed by the flight surgeon could very well be Dr. Detlef Bronk, who is on the original Harry S. Truman Majestic 12 list of experts to advise and study and monitor the extraterrestrial situation, and Major Charles Ray. Now, an interesting point is that the Colonel flight surgeon told Ronald Sukoy that at one point, perhaps overcome by what he said was a horrible stench in the room and it was warm, that the two doctors doing the autopsy asked to take a break, and everybody took a break, and the flight surgeon could no longer hold back. He vomited. When the general realized that the flight surgeon was really upset and had vomited, here now is what happened next.
All right.
And I said, well, what happened? next? And he said, they took me up the hall, and they never take me back. And I said, are you saying you didn't do a good job? And he said, from their perspective, I don't think I did do a good job, that I was the wrong man. And that's when he broke down again, and he said, and I was the wrong man, and why did they do this to me? I'm not a specialist. I'm not a pathologist. I wasn't a real surgeon that did surgery on people. I was just a basic doctor. Why me? They shouldn't have involved this in my life. I shouldn't have been caught up in this. And then to threaten me and tell me I could be court-martialed if I ever told anybody that I could be imprisoned for the rest of my life. That's when I realized he'd been carrying this thing inside of him all these years and replaying this. It went through my head. There's got to be moments that this comes back to him, maybe on a daily basis, that he's been locked in this nightmare.
And you are talking to me on June 27th, 2006, about all of this. Why?
Well, this shook me up, too. And I'm a man of my word. I carried this inside myself for years. And needless to say, you know, every time I would see a movie or something on television or Star Trek or anything, I would relive these moments of discussing these events with this man all through these decades. But I never thought about telling anybody. One, I gave my word, but two, who would you tell it to? And I didn't want to be thought of as being crazy, because back in those times, that many years ago, if anybody said they believed in aliens or whatever, you'd be laughed at. There wasn't the kind of revelations that have come out over the last 30 years. But over the course of time, I began to see things on television and hearing events, and quite frankly, you. The number of times that I've heard you on radio giving very detailed interviews with people and uncovering facts, and it would be like pieces of a puzzle. And one day I had this thought in my head that this whole issue is like this gigantic, huge puzzle the size of a basketball court or something with all these pieces. It's so complex, and you got to turn over all the pieces to see the whole picture of what this whole thing is, that this is a gigantic thing to comprehend, and I know one little piece of the puzzle, that's all. But it's one little piece that somebody ought to come forward, because over the course of time, as I would hear things about this on these talk radio programs that I like to listen to, I used to get angry of, why don't these people come forward? These people that went through this and knew things about this, and then one day it just dawned on me, well, you know something about this and you haven't come forward. And so that disturbed me for some time, and I thought about that, but how do I do this and who would listen to me? And I just heard about it, and I didn't see it myself. And then one day I said, I've been to your webpage before, and I went back, but I'd never even looked at it in terms of contacting you. I just would look to see what was there at Earth Files. I decided to go back again. I looked it over, and then that's when I saw the thing about how to contact you. And I swallowed hard, and then I didn't do it. I backed out, and I thought about it for a day, and I went back, and I said, okay, I'm going to do this. And that's when I entered the message in to contact you. And then a couple weeks went by, and I said, well, I did it. But she isn't going to contact me back. And the very day that I said she isn't going to contact me back, there was an email from you. These bodies, they came from somewhere. That means that there were people that handled them. They were transported across the United States. There were people involved. They came to Wright-Patterson. And if they were there at Wright-Patterson, that means people knew about it. In that building when this autopsy was going on with this gentleman, there had to be, just in that area, by the conversation I had with him, I counted up in my head, there had to be a dozen people right there. And then those people had other people around them. The security, the doctors, the generals, their support staff. How many people know about this? And if there are that many people involved, how can it be that so many people don't come forward? And then I realized, when I think about that, I'm looking at this dynamic human being, college educated, a doctor, a colonel in the Air Force, that this shattered his life, and that he was afraid. He was afraid by the threats they made against him. If you could intimidate such a dynamic individual that's a colonel in the military, that he's terrified that they'll ruin his life, that they'll allow to put him in a room someplace for the rest of his life and he'll never get out if he would ever convey what he saw or heard to anybody else, what do they do to lesser people?
Did they threaten him with anything else besides court-martial and being drummed out of the military?
Yes. I asked him specifically if he had ever told this to anybody, and he said he'd never told anybody. He'd never discussed it with his wife. it became very evident why he was so emotionally disturbed by all this. And he said, these people mean business. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, this isn't like the regular military. These aren't really the regular military. And when they threaten you, they mean it. And I said, do you mean they could harm you? And he said, I was threatened in such a way I had the feeling that if I really did tell my wife or other people that they might be surveilling me, they might know this, and that I might end up someplace in a room someplace or even dead. But he was more concerned, I think, about imprisonment in some kind of facility where they put people like this to get them away from being able to tell what they know.
Did he talk to you specifically with knowledge that our government or whatever the shadow secret group is that is running things, that they have facilities where they have locked away people who had firsthand knowledge about the extraterrestrials?
No, he didn't talk about that. But one thing he did mention was that I asked him, do you think that this is the only event of this kind that happened? I mean, you know, these things came from somewhere. They were injured and killed. That means that they had an accident or there was combat between us and them or something. I asked him from his military experience and background, did he think that this was the only event of its kind? And he shook his head no, and he said, no, I don't believe that. He said, I think this government knows a lot about these things and that we have a lot more things than just this. And I said, you mean like craft or debris? And he goes, well, we got these bodies. Don't you think we have debris? And that means we've got facilities to handle bodies, and we got facilities to handle debris. And I went, oh. I said, you're talking the word cover-up. And he goes, it's got to be huge.
Huge is right. And after that year of 1975, when this Colonel Flight Surgeon just kind of broke like a dam that had been held for so long and cried and shook in front of this man who worked for him that he had come to trust like a son, Ronald Sequoy ended up meeting somebody else who worked as a shift supervisor of security at Wright-Patterson. And he told me that in a discussion with a shift supervisor security at Wright-Patterson, and now I'm quoting from an email, he told me of a building there that he could not go near, that it had a separate security detail of all commissioned officers only, and that only big-time brass ever came or went. And he said to me, what you described inside of that building, that he himself could not say did not occur. And the man, this security supervisor at Wright-Patterson, told Ronald Sequoy, after they had this brief discussion about this building, that even the security supervisor could not go near. Mm-hmm. He said, quote, I don't want to ever discuss this with you again, and this conversation never happened, unquote. And Ronald Sequoy said, even though it's brief, without a lot of detail, that there was something chilling about having that kind of a conversation when he had simply tried to discuss some of the things that the Colonel Flight Surgeon had told him, and that's what he was met with. And while we were listening to this latest audio segment, I received a brief email on my computer from somebody who says, talking about a graduate from the University of Dayton in Ohio, quote, one day she related to me something her boyfriend told her in the 1960s that he got from his father, who was a colonel at Wright-Patterson. He told her about this thing called Project Blue Book and the fact that Wright-Patterson had three alien bodies held in a freezer.
Jeez.
Okay, that's an email that has come in tonight. And as we go into this next half hour, well, we will have some fascinating insights from Ronald Sequoy. And then, George, I would like to talk about some of the descriptions of extraterrestrial biological entities as they exist in some of these leaked government documents and the comparisons to what Thomas Coleman Shepard has said and what Ronald Sequoy has described from this flight search.
How are you spelling Sequoy's last name?
It's capital F-E, capital C-O-Y.
F-E?
S as in Sam.
S-E.
Yeah, it's capital. And if you go to Earth Files and just click on that report, it's right at the top. The hot link goes right to the report, and everything is there.
This is just an absolutely stunning story. I mean, you have investigated UFO stories and cases for a long, long time. Linda, how would you categorize this one? Where would you put it?
The last 5 to 6 months has been a continual evolution of some of the strongest military information that I have ever received. And I think that Thomas Coleman Shepard, combined with this flight surgeon's story accounting to Ronald Sequoy, you put the two together with some of the leaked documents, and I think we're beginning to get honest insights into what really has happened.
Sequoy sounds very deliberate. He sounds, I don't want to say he sounds well rehearsed, but he seems to know his subject matter real well.
Yes. He is a person who's very sharp of mind. And once upon a time, locally, he even did some radio.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so he has a mind that is one of those minds where you can, you recall your, I have a kind of flypaper mind, and he does, and so I understand it. I understand that you can have a memory of things in great detail of that have impressed you, as things have me, and I have a almost total recall on something.
Yo, tell me about it, Linda. I'll be back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM. Well, sometimes they say, Linda, you keep the best to last. Let's see what this final segment's all about, huh?
Well, I would imagine that there are a lot of Coast listeners, as I was on the phone, thinking the government, if it knows all of this and has had a policy of denial in the interest of national security, and it's now 60-some years later, why is the lie so entrenched? And my conversation with Ronald Sequoy was one in which I found his insight to be maybe as penetrating as anybody that I've ever discussed with, and part of his insight came from the Colonel flight surgeon. Let's continue listening.
All right, here we go.
I think they're going to want to give an excuse for why they didn't come forward, and they're going to use, they were trying to protect society, trying to keep things from harming society, the upsetting of religious systems, the upsetting of governments, and all. They're going to come up with every excuse you can think of to tell us why they just didn't come forward and tell the truth. They're going to come up with stories to cover you know what. Well, a lot of people, when this unfolds in society, are going to try to say things and do things to cover you know what, because a lot of people will be asking tough questions. Who do you think you were?
And are.
Yeah, and are. Exactly, because it's ongoing. There are people that did this in the 50s, and there's people doing this now.
And what is it that they are covering up and will lie about?
It's got to be one word. Power. You got craft that can come here from someplace else. That's enormous power. They've got to be able to do all sorts of things that we're not discussing in this conversation. If you can get in a craft and come from another world, what things are you doing in this world? And if you are somehow a powerful individual on this planet, I mean government, military, whatever, and you're interrelating with them at some level, whether you actually have direct contact with them and can communicate with them, or you just have their down craft and you can examine it, we're talking about enormous power. What are you doing with that enormous power? How are you applying that knowledge that you've gained? Like, for instance, these craft. If you can come here from another world, that means you've got the energy thing licked. Well, if you've got the energy thing licked, we don't have to burn oil anymore to light buildings and drive vehicles. There's got to be another way to do everything. And we wouldn't pollute our world. There's all kind of answers here that are being withheld from the general public because they're controlling it and they're making the financial gain from it.
And that kind of corrupt power doesn't want to let go easily. So what would you predict might be the future evolution of all of this on this planet?
Well, as long as they can withhold the real relationships, you don't know what goes on behind closed doors at gigantic multinational companies, people that control military-industrial complex, that sort of thing. The people behind all this and their activities, the real deep stuff, they're only going to want us to see a facade. They're going to want us to see, like if you're looking at a gigantic building, they may want to show you the building, and you can walk around the building and look at it, but they're not going to let you get inside that building. And then inside that building are rooms where things go on. They're not going to want you to even know about the rooms, let alone what goes on inside those rooms. So when they release this data, this supposed unveiling of things that you know eventually has got to come, it will be controlled. And they're going to tell us what they want us to know and how much of it will be the truth and how much will be a multi-year, carefully crafted story.
And the subjects that are the hardest for them are global animal mutilations being done by extraterrestrial biological entities, the abduction of human beings in a beam technology that is used also to pick up these animals, take tissue and fluid and return them, the presence of technologies that could solve the energy problem. What does this secret, powerful, controlling human/ET body that is keeping all of these details from us, how are they going to handle these hard pieces of physical evidence that link directly to the extraterrestrials?
Well, they're not. These are the type of things, when I said they're going to paint a picture, look, let's say that you're the mafia, and you can't help it. There's too many reporters coming at you, and pieces of your structure are coming out, and you're going to be in a situation where you've got to be exposed. You've always lived secret and hidden. Well, you're going to help expose yourself in certain areas and tell a lie about it so they don't get the real truth behind it. Well, that's what they're going to do. They're going to tell us a story about why they've been here and what they do here and who they've interchanged with, constructed timeline history of events. That's basic human nature. Everybody that is caught tells a story. And if you think you can tell part of the truth and withhold the most damning evidence, that's what you do. Well, the kind of things you just described, would anybody who was involved with them and had the facts of it, and they were supposed to be part of our government, would they ever want to turn and look at a camera and say, oh, by the way, we have all known about this for years, we just didn't want to tell you? Well, I don't think they're going to own up to that.
And what do they say directly to a question, what are the extraterrestrials doing with all these mutilated animals around the world?
I've heard about these kind of things, and I've used the word agenda several times here. Well, there's another word that goes hand in hand with agenda. Why you've got one is the word need. If they've got an agenda and they're doing activities like that, they need to be doing that. This isn't just us being laboratory rats. Everything they needed to know about us, if they're this smart and they've been coming here this long, they know as much about us as our own doctors and our own university scientists know about us. So why are they still doing this? They've got a need of some kind. They need to be doing this, these entities. And the question is, what's that need? Why do they need to be on our planet? Why do they need to interact with us at a hidden level and be working with our animals and working with abducting human beings? What's the need? They've got one.
He sounds frustrated too, Linda, doesn't he?
Yes. And you can understand why. I think all of us who have investigated and been exposed to the subject for some period of time, we realize that one of the, we'll say, common denominators to the possible agenda that is hinted at in some documents, but certainly in the hard physical evidence of what has come out of animal mutilations and what humans in the human abduction syndrome describe, and that is a genetic harvest. There may be other purposes, but sperm and ova and tissue and fluid is being taken from Earth life, and that means it's being used for something. And Jim Sparks, one of the abductees that I focused on in my book, Glimpses of Other Realities, he very detailed described the kind of android, part machine, part biological combination, and that there are controllers of the androids, and that the controllers have the minds that overwhelm the humans, but that the little androids are the ones that have mostly interfaced with humans in the abduction syndrome, maybe the animals, and that they are programmed machines the way we would make a vacuum cleaner to do a particular chore, but that in this whole huge complex aspect of the phenomena, that these beings, that the colonel's flight surgeon was clearly describing something that was part robotic and part biological, that we are beginning to realize that the government insiders caught on to the fact that when they went to a craft that was down, and if there were entities, they might not be the entities that are even the controllers and makers of the craft and these little androids. They caught on to the fact that they were dealing with worker bees and that there was something else, highly more advanced, that was involved with getting them here. And now this brings us to what I always have thought is one of the most important leaked documents of all time, and that is what is referred to as the SOM 101 training manual by Majestic 12 Group.
Right.
With a date of April 1954 on it. And for those who might not remember or realize, these were 32 pages of text and drawings that first appeared on 35 millimeter black and white negative film. And it was in a package that had been mailed to Don Berliner at the Fund for UFO Research in Maryland. The package was postmarked March 7th, 1994, from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Well, Don Berliner was a friend of Bob Wood, who is a PhD and now retired aerospace engineer from McDonnell Douglas. And Bob Wood agreed that he would take those negatives and blow them up and start the painstaking analysis of these words blown up from pages that included, George, the hand of the person who was taking photographs of these pages. The hand is holding the pages flat so they can be photographed. That hand is in the photographs of these 32 pages. I have reprinted the entire 32 pages in my book, Glimpses of Other Realities. Bob and Ryan Wood, in their very important MajesticDocuments.com website, they have the SOM 101 document. And to date, after 12 years, no one anywhere has ever been able to disprove the SOM 101 training manual is not absolutely a legitimate leaked document. And the title of the SOM 101 training manual with the April 1954 date on it and a War Department logo, the title is Extraterrestrial Entities and Technology Recovery and Disposal, Top Secret Magic, Eyes Only. And on one of the pages inside, it's page 6, in the form that I have it, there is a paragraph. It's called Paragraph 10, Description of Extraterrestrial Biological Entities, or EBES, as an acronym, E-B-E-S. Examination of remains recovered from wreckage of UFOBS. And you'll find in government documents that instead of UFOs, they will use UFOB, all caps, in a little S. That seemed to be one of the delineators within the government insiders themselves, that they would not use the public UFO, but they had UFOBS or UAVs, unidentified aerial vehicles, or UACs, unidentified aerial craft. So now they're talking about extraterrestrial biological entities that have been taken from this crash technology. And they're classifying them into two distinct categories as follows. They call it EBA type 1. These entities are humanoid and might be mistaken for human beings of the Oriental race if seen from a distance. They are bipedal, 5 feet to 5 foot 4 inches in height, and weigh 80 to 100 pounds. Already, George, this is taller than what the flight surgeon was watching in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the 4 foot, what he referred to as doll-like. Proportionally, they are similar to humans, although the cranium is somewhat larger and more rounded. The skin is a pale, chalky yellow in color. This is different than the gray pink described in the Interplanetary Phenomena Unit document. thick and slightly pebbled in appearance. Now, that matches Thomas Coleman Shepard's description of the photograph that he and his colleagues saw Thanksgiving night, 1976, at Okinawa.
What do they mean by slightly pebbled?
These are the bumps. Thomas Coleman Shepard drew them in his drawings for me of the photographs he saw. I have talked with many people in the human abduction syndrome, and they have referred to the skin on some of the entities that they have come face-to-face with consciously as saying, it reminded me of a lizard, or it reminded me of a reptile. A bumpy skin, not completely bumpy, but enough bump to make people think of something reptilian. It goes on and says, in these types, the taller types with the pebbled skin, the eyes are small, not big, wide-set, almond-shaped, with brownish-black irises with very large pupils. And the whites of the eyes are not like that of humans. They have a pale gray cast. The ears are small and set low on the skull. The nose is thin and long, and the mouth is wider than in humans and nearly lipless. There is no apparent facial hair and very little body hair, that being very fine and confined to the underarm and the groin area. The body is thin and without apparent body fat, but the muscles are well developed. The hands are small with four long digits, but no opposable thumb. The outside digit is jointed in a manner as to be nearly opposable, and there is no webbing between the finger as in humans. The legs are slightly but noticeably bowed, and the feet are somewhat splayed and proportionally large. So again, this is the difference. These are muscular. Now, let's go to EBA type 2, which sounds very much more like what might have been on that surgery table.
Okay.
These entities are humanoid but differ from type 1 in many respects. They are bipedal, 3.5 feet to 4'2" in height, and weigh maybe 25 to 50 pounds. That is small. Proportionally, the head is much larger than humans or type 1 EBAs. Remember, the flight surgeon looking at the head thought of an insect because of the proportion of the head to the body and the shape.
Are these like Whitley's grays?
Well, it's a very interesting question that the drawing, and if Whitley were on the phone with us, I think that what Whitley would say is that he thought that he interacted with both types.
I'm going to ask. I'm with him tomorrow for dinner, by the way.
Okay.
So
well,
I'll ask
him. Go over this, because I think that the little ones, I think Whitley would say that the little ones he caught on were android-like and robotic, but that there are the taller ones. They have heavy-duty minds and the ability to download and upload information from human minds telepathically, and I think that's what the taller ones are, and that these little ones that the flight surgeon was talking about as being doll-like is this perhaps more like this EBA type 2 in the Psalm 101 document, says the cranium is much larger and elongated. The eyes are very large, slanted, and nearly wrap around the side of the skull. They are black with no white showing. And between Colonel Corsell, the flight surgeon, and others who have said that they saw eyes that they thought were optical devices, that may be, again, why they are these big, black, wraparound eyes. They're not organic. They're optical mechanical.
I was going to say, what if their cameras beaming back television-type signals to the ETs who might be up in a mothership or something?
Well, whatever they, the little ones, wherever their upload is to, remember it was Colonel Corso was describing that he had firsthand knowledge of those lenses that were allowing the entities to look at the world around them through infrared. And that means that these optical devices may be both, they could be both in the androids, and they could be also used by the taller major intelligence. When it goes on into this little one, it talks about how long the arms are in proportion to the legs, and that the hands have three long tapering fingers and a thumb which is nearly as long as the fingers. Everyone seems to agree about these very long fingers. And now we've had two testimonies from military people about those pads at the end of the fingertip, and I've heard this from abductees over the last 20-some years that people have said, you know, those little frogs that have suction cups at the end of their fingers, they said that's what they look like. But there is no mention of that in this Psalm 101 document. So are we dealing with 2, 3, 4 or more types of androids, and that that Wright-Patterson and our military and Majestic 12 were learning with each autopsy that, oh my gosh, we've got a different one. That might have happened. And the final sentences in the Psalm 101 about the Ebas, quote, "It is not definitely known where either type of creature originated, but it seems certain they did not evolve on Earth. It is further evident, although not certain, that they may have originated on two different planets."
We'll be back with questions now with Linda Moulton Howe. I wonder what some of the brass in the military might be thinking tonight, Linda, if they're listening to this program. What do you think?
Well, I hope some of them would be saying, and I need to switch to another phone. I realize I was on a noisy walk around for a second at the computer. Here I am.
Okay.
I would hope that some of them would say, well, at last, some of the facts are finally being delivered, while others will probably be saying, well, this is against our policy of denial in the interest of national security, and maybe all of us are being looked at almost like a test, because if they've been afraid of public reaction to the truth, I would say that by 2006, the Coast audience certainly is able to absorb these facts and a lot more. What we want is the truth.
Let's go to the phones now. Linda, you ready?
I am.
We'll pick it up by going to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Good morning. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Rosie, and I'm calling from Pennsylvania.
All right, Rosie.
And I was just calling to say, Linda, thank you so much because for doing all this. About 20 years ago, I came face-to-face to one of these beings. And when I told my brother, when I told my mother, when I told everybody in my family, they could say, no, you were dreaming. But now, after all the description that I've heard for what Linda has been saying, it's like, it's true. You know, I mean, this was like an almond-shaped eye, and he was, like, staring at me as if he was, I don't know, he was just, like, staring. And the skin was just, like, you know, like you mentioned, like almost reptile-like. And this went on for about 5 minutes.
And was this in your house, your bedroom, where?
It was in my bedroom. I was laying, my bed was right next to my window, and this was back in Texas, actually. And I opened my eyes because I felt like if somebody was looking at me, and when I opened my eyes, I saw this being right at the window staring, and it was more like trying, like looking right through me.
And was the being outside the window floating or inside your room as if it had come
to... He was outside. He was outside, and he was, like, holding onto the windowsill. You know, like, when little kids can't quite reach to look over the over a table or over something, and you can just see, like, the fingers, and you can see, like, if they're, like, trying to stand on tiptoes, trying to look.
So this was a small being.
Yes, it was. And it had, like, almond-shaped eyes, and the fingers were, like, very long. I didn't quite see like a nose or anything, yet there was like a little hole where I could see that's where he was breathing from. I did not see lips. It was quite interesting, and I mean, we stared at each other for about a good 5 minutes, and after that I closed my eyes. When I opened them again, I saw him almost gliding. It wasn't like running, he was like gliding towards the end of the backyard. And he went right into a field.
And did you feel like during that staring that you were getting any images, symbols, or thoughts that were not your own?
Most of the thoughts were of curiosity, you know. It felt more like if he was a child trying to see, like, what is it? You know, kind of like, what are you? Like, like, what are you doing, or like, who are you kind of thing, you know? That's basically what I gathered the most.
Did you feel that, like you wanted to walk over to the window to see if you could look closer?
I was very close. Believe me, if I would have reached out my arm, I could have touched his fingers. That's how close we were.
And yet, this is an one time. This never happened before or since in your life?
Correct.
And that's unusual, because usually people have a pattern of these kinds of events, and that's what I wondered. Do you think that anything like that ever happened when you were small?
Nothing that I can remember, but I know a lot of, like, weird things have happened, you know, in my life where sometimes I just know that something's going to happen, and just, like, all of a sudden it feels like I'm being pulled back. Like, I've been close to very, a lot of unexplainable things. I just couldn't really, you know.
And you, like, probably have the question that so many people in the human abduction syndrome have, which is, why me? If we are dealing with a variety of non-humans that may be actually based on this planet for a quarter of a billion years, and we happen to be the current surface life, and that they've got a bunch of agendas that we don't know anything about, why does there seem to be a concentration on only certain people through a life? And some of the hypotheses are that we're dealing with intelligences that are actually monitoring and tracking bloodlines. And if so, to what end? This is one of the greater mysteries in this entire extraterrestrial phenomenon.
They know what they're doing, Linda, and I think they've been doing it for a very long time.
I know it's been a long time, yeah.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, I'm George from Lafayette, Louisiana.
Yeah, hello, George. Thanks for being part of the program. Go ahead.
Oh, thank y'all. Unbelievable show tonight. I know I won't be able to go to sleep after this one. But my question to Linda is, what do you think about the Sitchin research, which talks about the Nelfin and the Anunnaki and the Watchers from above? That the gray beings and these android species,
right,
how they tie into this. And as far as the government is concerned, and why they're not letting this out to the public, I don't see a lot of control in a government just amongst its own body. I mean, the head of the snake sometimes doesn't know what the tail is doing anyway.
So remember that flight surgeon told Ronald Sequoy that he was dealing with a unit in the military in terms of security and threat that was unlike anything he'd ever encountered. And that I know that privately he and Ronnie Sequoy in those conversations, that there was even an analogy, the way a mafia would work, a non-elected, non-appointed government. This is where these terms of what is below the tip of the iceberg, who is really running the planet, what are they, why are they playing such a tough ball on an issue that would seem to me a story that the entire human family should have right to know everything that its so-called leaders know about other life forms in the universe or other life forms in or under or on this planet. And the fact that there seems to be so much energy put in to control, power, secrecy at all costs. And when you read some of these documents, the majesticdocuments.com that have been leaked, and you realize that there, even in that Psalm 101 document that I was quoting from, there is a section that even discusses that if our government has a live extraterrestrial biological entity from some crash or craft or landing, and if the presence of that extraterrestrial biological entity would be a threat to the secrecy, this is the word, then the termination of that entity would be sanctioned and understood.
Man, we would be opening up a can of worms, so don't you think?
Well, I personally I feel that this planet has been living a lie for such a long time, so many lies. It's deep in lies. And he asked a very interesting question about the Anunnaki in the Sumerian translation. This is not something made up. These tablets from the cuneiform in Mesopotamia go back 5,000 years and more. And there are arguments about translation. But in general, the tablets talk about a race of extraterrestrials that refer to themselves as Anunnaki, who are here on this planet to mine gold and what? Harvest genetic material and manipulate it. And it's all in the Anunnaki story that is in these clay tablets that Zechariah Sitchin has spent the last 40 years of his life translating and putting into books. And to me, it's like perhaps a slice of what has happened on this planet, because 5,000 years ago is not very long, and I've been exposed to information in many ways that suggest that we are dealing with at least two, I'm going to say, non-human hominid intelligences, that it may have been on this planet since before the time of the dinosaurs. And George, that pushes back 270 million years ago. And if we have had two competing or warring or whatever they do, intelligences using, mining, manipulating DNA on this planet for more than a quarter of a billion years, and you come to the current hominid, which is Homo sapiens, and you look, we're only, the hominid species on this Earth is only 2.6 million years old. And so there's been a whole variety of hominids. We're one of the latest. Take 2.6 million over 270 million. We're the latest kid on the block, for sure.
Okay, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Hi.
This is Betty from Portland, Oregon.
Welcome, Betty. And
I was very excited to hear Linda mention the Battle of Los Angeles. I was there. I saw an airplane shot down, and I don't remember if that was in 1940 or 1941.
February 1942. February
1942.
Yep.
Okay. Okay. Well, I do thank you. I've been wondering about that. You are the only one in all this time who has ever mentioned that when I bring up this fight. People think I'm crazy and they just don't believe me, but I was so happy to hear you mention it.
And in work that I have done in conferences, in presentations, and at my website, earthfiles.com, if you go to www.earthfiles.com and up in the quick search in the upper left, if you type in Battle of Los Angeles, you will see more than one report that I have done about it. And the most significant breakthrough in the last 5 years have been leaked documents from the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration that indicate that there was correspondence going on between FDR and George Marshall, his Army Chief of Staff, because of that Battle of L.A. And they specifically, the words in the communication between the President of the United States and his Army Chief of Staff, is referring to the objects over Los Angeles as interplanetary, celestial, and describes either we shot down or there was a crash. It's not quite clear. But we were being aggressive then, that there were two objects. They were referred to as similar to what was over the Santa Monica Mountains, but one was retrieved from San Bernardino area, mountain area, and one from another location. That means that night when you were watching that artillery fire and heard all of those sirens and saw all of those lights, the United States government was actively involved with either shooting down or something, but retrieved two craft that were described as interplanetary.
Thanks. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to the program. You're on the air with us. Hi there. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, good morning, sir.
Hello?
Hello? Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Hey, this is going to sound pretty bad, but I'm trying to say it as respectfully as possible.
But the interviews that she's flipping to, if you're listening to the speech patterns, it sure sounds scripted.
Scripted?
Scripted, as in they're both reading from a script.
Oh, my God.
Well, Linda has a script. She's the reporter.
Yeah, and this was a two-hour conversation on June 27th, which was at the time exploratory, and I always ask people for permission, but there was nothing in the 2 hours of conversation in which I had ever committed to doing anything for radio or anything.
And you didn't supply him any questions or nothing
that.
Well, as I said, it was just a...
I think it's really odd to me today that people who are articulate, and there are still some people in this dumbed-down country who can speak articulately, and it does not mean it's rehearsed or written.
And I can assure you, if Linda says it, you can take it to the bank.
Thank you.
you know, Linda, whether he's telling the truth or not, that's another point. But I got to tell you, I've heard a lot of interviews. He sounds pretty convincing to me.
And, you know, he's a very smart person. He is, if you just say somebody can remember things, we talked about that in an earlier hour. The fact that there are some people who have great articulation of memory does not mean that they have written it down. Being able to articulate a memory is, I think, goes with IQ.
Absolutely. Well, let's go to another caller. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yeah.
Linda, I'm Patrick from Alabama.
Yes, sir.
Patrick, go ahead.
And Linda, obviously, most of your military information comes from Air Force personnel.
No, it's Navy. It's all across the board.
Oh, is it? Okay. I've heard you mention the Navy before, and I was curious if you've gotten any information from Army personnel.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Because I was in the Army, and I was stationed at an installation where some strange things, or we were asked to do some strange things. I never saw anything out of the ordinary, but I've been listening to the show for about 2 years, and just some things that some guests have mentioned I have seen and kind of put two and two together, and I was just kind of curious as to...
Where were you?
I think we lost him on the phone there, Linda.
Yeah, it sounded like it. I'd be very interested if this caller can still hear, if you could email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com and tell me more details. Where were you, which base, what date, and all of that.
That's how you get your information, Linda. You got to fish it out that way.
Yes, you have to be persistent, too.
Yeah, no doubt. Are you traveling these days?
I think that I will be in Europe for a couple of weeks on several pieces of research that I'm doing. And one of them, if it works out, I will call you when I get back and we'll do something on Coast.
Okay, very good. Well, stick with us. We'll be back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe. And again, her website is earthfiles.com. If you need to email her, it's earthfiles@earthfiles.com. If you have some information on what we've been talking about tonight, go ahead and do that. Also, you can send me some information if you like. I'll forward it on to Linda. That's george@coast2to, coasttocoastam.com as well. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast. We'll take final questions. What a fast night. We'll be back. Okay, well, this final half hour is going to take off, so let's go right back to the phones. Wild card line, you're on the air with us. On Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah.
Hi, Linda.
Hi.
It's an honor to talk to both of you. My name's Chris from Hennepin, Illinois. I listen on Streamlink.
Yeah, great, Chris.
I was just wondering what Linda thought about the extent of maybe the government's knowledge about the extraterrestrials, like how much they really know. And just briefly, I've seen a craft when I was about 10 years old. And my father was even a commercial pilot, and, you know, it was just defied logic, you know, defied physics. And I was just kind of wondering what Linda thought about all that.
Okay, now, and what do you mean about how much they really know?
Do you think they've actually made contact with the entities and, like, know really who they are?
Well, I can share a firsthand experience from a man who worked for the U.S. Air Force. And this goes back into the 1970s. And it's a very long story, but I will give you the short paragraph. He said that he was in a unit that went to areas where extraterrestrial biological entities were interacting, either with each other in some kind of conflict, or were interacting with the surface of the Earth in ways that our government was constantly trying to understand and monitor. And he said, we are dealing with at least three major types. The Ebens, those would be the taller extraterrestrial biological entities that would probably be that type that I read from the Psalm 101, about 5'4", vertical pupiled eyes, certainly of a reptilian cast, but extremely powerful minds. And he said we were using those to try to understand and interact with two other groups. The other group he called the Nordics, and a third he called the standing up lizards or reptiles. And he said that a dam in above a town in the southwest had been broken. Specifically, our government had gotten a Hertz frequency signal from some kind of a satellite that it was a craft from the Blondes that had deliberately broken the dam, and the water was flooding, and they didn't understand why. And he said they could send out signals. Remember when Spielberg had the wonderful Encounters movie in which the boy was dealing with a little E.T. Who somehow telepathed to him that when he was sick, if they could get him or send out a signal and he could get his civilization to come, that he might be cured. Well, it was the same idea, that we don't have the ability to just push a button and have them here, but that there was some way to communicate. And the long story is that he was involved with going to a town in which one extraterrestrial group had done something to a dam that released water, and another extraterrestrial group literally was trying to help us understand what had happened.
This week I had Mary Rodwell on as a guest, and she has done some work with Star Kids, and you know, she believes that extraterrestrials are not bad at all. And I'm not so sure about that, Linda. I sometimes take the David Jacobs approach that some of these entities are pretty bad.
Well, we're not talking about one of anything. Never have been. It's becoming so clear in discussions that I've had with people in a wide variety of either jobs in intelligence or military, that there is at least common knowledge about at least three main groups. And I just talked about the Nordics, the Ebens, and what would be a true standing-up lizard-looking reptilian, which on the face of it might sound scary to some listeners, and maybe I've been exposed to it for so long in the human abduction syndrome. I'm not certain if people understand that if you go back into the early 60s and you come forward, that there have been hundreds and hundreds of people who have had face-to-face. We're in Colorado. I talked with two women, two different incidents, two different places, and one had been out riding a horse and another was walking on a path. And in each case, it was a standing up alligator. And when people describe these encounters with entities in pure daylight, totally conscious, that really, those are the cases that I have spent more time on. And I know that there's been a huge variety. Now, why is it that the entities themselves in all these three categories don't just make themselves known in a public, a huge demonstration? It seems that the secrecy that the government or governments want is serving some purpose by these intelligences. And that has always made me nervous. If everything were straight, above board, wonderful, we're going to help your planet have energy that's not going to pollute, we're going to help you with all the things that we have learned as an advanced species, why wouldn't that be a happy win-win day for everybody? Instead, when you look at the last 5,000 years, going back to the clay tablets of Mesopotamia about the Anunnaki, those alleged extraterrestrials they weren't nice at all. No. And they certainly were not nice to humans.
East of the Rockies, you're up with us. Hi there. Good morning.
Hi, this is Joanne. I'm calling from Missouri.
Okay. Whereabouts?
Cape Girardeau.
Oh, yeah. That's where my son went to college.
Nice town.
Yeah, sure is. And there was a crashed saucer there back in the 40s.
1941.
Yeah.
1931.
Well, the dates that we have in all the government documents is 1941.
Yeah.
If you have information,
yeah. Maybe
about
another one.
Well, our newspaper puts out like what happened 25 years ago, 50, 75, and 100 years
mm-hmm.
ago. And 75 years ago, which would be 1931, there was a lot of officials from Washington, D.C. and the military that swarmed into Cape Girardeau because they were sure that this thing was going to land. Of course, that was before I was born, and I don't know what happened about it. It didn't say a lot about it in the paper, but I have had a lot of UFO experiences, and I talked to a professor at the university here named Harley Rutledge. You may know him.
Oh, sure.
And he told me that UFOs and angels and different things like that do not make themselves known to everybody. It's just certain people, and certain people can pick this stuff up out of the sky. I was actually chased by a UFO. I had my four children in the car. They were screaming hysterical. This thing hovered right above our car. It was the brightest of bright light. I mean, I didn't know what to do. I was screaming. I was only trying to get home to where my husband was. And then I got home, and when I turned down my street, it just was gone. I mean, it didn't make a sound. There was no sound when it was right over me, and it didn't make a sound when it left. I mean, I was driving really fast. But that's what he told me, that I should not have gone home because then they would know where I lived.
Oh, well, they'll know that anyway. But listen, let me ask you something seriously. Do you have a copy of the newspaper that talks about the 75 years ago event?
No, but I could get it. It was earlier this year.
I would greatly appreciate it if you would, and if you could send me a copy either through hard mail. My post office box is at earthfiles.com. All of the ways to contact me by fax, phone, email, and hard mail are at my website, earthfiles.com, and I would very much like
again?
To.
I'm sorry?
Give me your web again.
It's www.earthfiles. Think of a reporter filing news about
right.
the Earth. So it's E-A-R-T-H, F as in Frank, I-L-E-S as in Sam,
yes.
earthfiles.com.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let's go to some more calls because we've only got about 9 minutes left. Wildcard Line, good morning. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hi.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I just wanted to offer a couple of perspectives, and Linda's probably realized this by now, but the reason she's having such a hard time getting information is, you know, I speaking as a former military person myself, it's not because they're afraid to tell, but and any military man listening will tell you, it's because he's afraid of dishonoring his oath. This is an honor thing. So you're just not going to have military people, if they have this type of clearance, if this exists, they're not just going to walk right up and tell you what you want to know.
Oh, I understand that, sir. But my problem is we are supposed to be living in a democracy in which the taxpayers' dollars pay for the government, and we're supposed to elect people who represent us in the government. Everything has been turned upside down. We have a government that has taken a position that in the interest of national security, something as significant as contact with other intelligences and their technology should be kept from the public.
Well, I understand your point, but and see, this is the thing. In politics and in real-world living, you know, you can't get two people to keep a secret and be on the same page. But the military is a different machine. Once you raise your hand and you take the oath and you swear to, you know, protect your country at all costs, it's not something you give up. And you can try to use whatever logic you would like to break that code, but that's the part that's compelling about the story. This man would take this to his grave for honor's sake.
And
but it would,
And I understand that, and I am extremely grateful that I have been seeing over the last 4 or 5 years of this administration an increasing frustration by people who have served in the military and who are fed up by the lies, are fed up by the deceit, are fed up in a country that seems to be turning itself upside down, in which the taxpayers are looked at as hamsters in a cage to keep the economy going, but that we are not, as a nation, supposed to know what our so-called leaders are keeping from us. Everything has been turned upside down. And if we are dealing with 3 different extraterrestrial agendas on this planet, to just for openers, I think the entire human family should know, not something that should be kept in the confines of inner sanctums in the military and in the government that we are paying for.
And it's probably been going on for a long, long time, Linda. You, a couple months ago, talking about a long time ago, you did an update for us on the large buried Utah craft. Remember that one? Anything new to that?
Well, it's still an issue of how to pay for the kind of research that we need to see if anything is still there. That has not been done. All of us, we do what we can do on scarce resources while the government has trillions, right? And so it's kind of an uneven playing field.
East of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
How about George? Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Long-time listener, and I am a big fan. Linda, how are you?
Hi.
I just sent a fast blast to the show, and I also sent you an email, Linda. I was in the Army at Fort Bliss in El Paso, Texas, which, as you know, is right down the road from White Sands Missile Range. I was stationed there from 79 until 80. I got orders to go to Germany. I was attached to the Army Security Agency there on Biggs Airfield. About 2 o'clock one morning, it had to be 1980, the same year that I got orders to go to Germany. It loaded all the physical security MPs, which worked at the communications building with me. They put us in a deuce and a half. They took two Russian linguists and a Chinese linguist. They made us put on our NBC nuclear biological suits, and they trucked us to White Sands. We went to a small clapboard building that looked like it wasn't secure enough to be part of an army installation or whatever. We loaded a box into the back of the truck, set it between us on the floor of the deuce and a half. As you know, there's seats on either side. If you've seen, military army movies or what anybody's been in the military, we took this box to 5th General Hospital over on Main Post in El Paso. When we got back, they took us back to the communications building that we all worked in and said, "You didn't make the trip. You didn't see anything. We never went to White Sands. And if anybody does speak about this, you're subject to either court martial, or we will make sure you get stationed somewhere where nobody will believe you." Now, if it had to be some kind, I told the call screen, if it was anything having to do with a missile, I don't understand why we went to 5th General Hospital. Right. As you know, that's where they had General Bradley at 5th General before he died. The last of the living 5-star generals. And we all thought it was kind of weird that the box was a little bit cool, and we were just sitting there with our NBC suits on because we were all, enlisted people. And we had a bird colonel in the front seat with the first sergeant from our company. And it just seemed real strange, and why they would take linguists, and they always told us we were a listening post for the Gulf, Gulf of Mexico. I thought, well, that's kind of weird. We're way out in El Paso, Texas, on an airfield. But, being a good soldier, I didn't ask any questions. I was just an E-4 at the time. And I went into the radio room one night when I was on my shift, and there was no actual maps of the Gulf Coast. It was all looked like aerial photographs of Texas and some of the Gulf Coast, actually. But then there was a lot of it looked like stuff that had been taken with a satellite of the sky. I just put those two together as I was listening to the program tonight. And thought, well, maybe I had been inadvertently involved in taking something from White Sands to 5th General Hospital. And I just wanted to call in. And like I said, I sent you an email about all this incident. And it's
and does your
really
email have
me.
A way for me to contact you?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I would like to talk with you more. And the bottom line is that back in the 1947 period when there were at least three crash retrievals between July 4th and July 6th, 1947, according to the leaked Majestic 12 documents, that security people coming out, SED personnel coming out of Los Alamos, went to at least one of the crash sites at Trinity site at White Sands. There were four, and they were wearing supposed protective suits. But all four of those SED personnel were dead within 48 hours from profuse hemorrhaging from every orifice. And the documents refer to the possibility of an alien virus of great concern, and it might explain that any crew, military or otherwise, who would be dealing with a crash or extraterrestrials would have to go in to biological chemical suits because they don't know what they might run into.
Okay, very good. Linda, we've only got about a minute left or so. What would you like people to send you if there's anybody out there with more information?
It's hard firsthand information that I'm trying to gather, meaning if anybody listening wants to talk with me off the record, I always respect confidences. If you can speak with me on the record, that's great. And what I'm trying to do is keep increasing the knowledge of firsthand experience and knowledge concerning an extraterrestrial or, let's say, non-human presence on this planet, because if we're dealing with intelligences that have actually occupied the Earth for more than a quarter of a billion years, they aren't technically extraterrestrial, even if their original source is not from here. That is the confusing part of this story, and the government gets away with a shell game of saying there are no extraterrestrials. Because what they mean is we're dealing with other intelligences that may have been here for a quarter of a billion years.
All right, Linda, thanks so much. Great report. Nice job.
Thank you.
Linda Moulton Howe. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Sloanhood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.